Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown.
Churchill's Citadel is a major new history of Churchill in the 1930s, showing how his meetings at Chartwell, his country home, strengthened his fight against the Nazis. It is a fascinating new book by Catherine Carter. I'm delighted to say that Catherine joins us live on the line now. Catherine, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Just good to have you with us. We seem to think that Churchill sort of sprung fully formed in his determination at the outbreak of the Second World War, you know, with his loathing of the Nazis and if you like, his game plan of how to get Great Britain to stand firm. But of course, he must have plotted this somewhere. He must have had realizations. And though we may think Chequers, it is in fact another house that has a crucial part in his development.
His country home at Chartwell is the place that deserves center stage in terms of him preparing for the wartime leadership that awaited him in 1940. And my book, Churchill's Citadel, charts the meetings that were happening behind the closed doors of his country home that ultimately informed his understanding of what was going on in Germany and therefore the position he took against the Nazis.
Those who don't know, where that is Chartwell, by the way?
Chartwell is in Kent. It's in the northern part of Kent. And he lived there from, well, he bought it in 1922, spent 2 years completely renovating it, and then lived there from 24 until he passed away in 65. So it's his main home for the latter half of his life.
And so basically it's his home base from which he can, you know, he can sally forth. And it's all, presumably a place of refuge as well, in those run-ups, the pre-war years, which we're going to look at now, but also in the tumultuous days after the war and his interesting sort of post-war career.
It is the place that he held more dear to his heart than anywhere else in the world. There's a wonderful quote of his which says, "A day away from Chartwell is a day wasted." One which I think is very, very true. And it certainly was the place where, away from the prying eyes of Westminster and London, he could have these meetings in the comfort of his own home, on his home turf, if you will. And to his home, he was bringing military figures, diplomats, politicians, scientists, the people he needed to build this knowledge arsenal, if you will, of what was going on in Germany.
At the time, of course, he's, you know, in the 30s, he's looked at as a periphery figure. I mean, we now look back and think the great man. I mean, people who don't understand Churchill's right, you know, the bell arc that is his life, think that he was always put on a pedestal. But, you know, during the 30s, he's seen as a peripheral figure, as something and I use the word advisedly, as an extremist, if you like.
In the 1930s, he is on the backbenches of Westminster. He had been Chancellor of the Exchequer in the late 20s. And for a lot of people by the 30s, they probably thought that was the highest his career would ever achieve. You know, there were people who thought he was a spent force in politics and he, you know, wasn't going to be in that level of power or influence again. So that's where he's on the 30s. He's on the back benches. He'd love to be back in government, but elections keep happening and he's never brought back. So everything he's doing in the 30s, he's doing from the position of lesser influence in Westminster.
Well, why does Churchill's antenna go off then to what's happening over in Germany? Because if you look at, say, the early 1930s, Germany is seen, Nazi Germany or National Socialist Germany, is seen as a progressive place. You have these wonderful work programs that are building these autobahns. You've got the airships going up, which are the, if you like, the symbol of superiority in the air. They're a modernist nation. They have motor racing cars. They're setting land speed records. It seems like they are a progressive nation, and they have rebuilt themselves, and we are sort of, we are embracing our German colleagues. And yet Churchill's got this distrust. Why is his antenna wiggling?
Winston Churchill makes a trip to Germany in the summer of 1932. And the reason he does this is because he is researching a biography he's writing of his ancestor, the first Duke of Marlborough, which turns out to be a million word, you know, four volume history that takes most of the 30s to write.
Does it have Blenheim in it now and again, just slightly?
Just once or twice. And so he goes to do this research trip. And whilst he's out there, he is seeing what he describes shortly after this trip as a war mentality. And at this point, Hitler isn't actually chancellor yet in late 1932, but you do have the Nazis growing rapidly in terms of their support. And he makes a speech in November 1932 saying there will be another conflict with Germany if steps aren't taken immediately, which, as you say, is totally against the prevailing consensus. And not only is it because of the reasons you just said, but also the First World War is recent memory at that point, and there are thousands of people who can't stomach the idea of any other war and will do everything they can to avoid it.
Because, obviously, we now look back at that knowing that the Second World War is an entirely different war to the First World War, mainly for several reasons, technology, air, you know, the air war, etc. But for anybody who's living in the 20s or early 30s, they just assume that the next war that comes, if there is going to be a war, will be the First World War, but on an even more horrific scale.
You're absolutely right. It is definitely the case that with the advances in technology, the assumption is that another war will see catastrophic global impacts, with likely targets of civilians as well, which isn't seen in the First World War. The assumption is that another future war will involve that and much greater use of war in the air, as you say. So Winston Churchill, in trying to sound the alarm that the Nazis are preparing for war and therefore Britain should be doing the same, is doing so in a climate where people just can't bear the thought, because the assumption is that it will be apocalyptic if war breaks out again.
How does Churchill then, who is this backbench figure, manage to attract this a quite incredible cast of people to come visit us? I mean, the visitors log at Chartwell must look absolutely magnificent. I mean, talk about a snapshot of who was where in the 30s. But because if he's a peripheral figure, I mean, I can't see many sort of backbenchers in the UK having those sort of people coming to a politician who wants to speak to such a wide range to get all this coming in. But also people would say, well, I'm very sorry, Winston, but I'm very, you know, I'm busy that day, and I might go yachting that weekend. So why are they coming to him?
By being among the first to take an official position against Adolf Hitler and against the Nazis, he then becomes someone around who those who are also in opposition can rally. But that has to be done away from Westminster, because there is so much determination to avoid future war. So Churchill's house almost becomes his own personal branch of the Foreign Office out in rural Kent, where he has the likes of Albert Einstein, who has by that point fled German persecution, and is coming to Winston Churchill's home because he is one of the few figures in Britain at that point who is voicing opposition to Hitler. And it is this draw of phenomenal individuals. You've got the former French Prime Minister, you've got the former German Chancellor, all these people with access to intelligence and information who can then bring that to Winston Churchill, to his front door, but also those who witnessed persecution and terror playing out in Germany as well. You've got people who are, you know, victims of the Night of the Long Knives in terms of those who were tempted to be assassinated, then coming to Winston Churchill's house to say what happened that night. So he's got this really rich tapestry developing at Chartwell of intelligence and people's recollections.
So hang on, you've got Night of the Long Knives is where Hitler gets rid of Sturm and all those guys, is it ever correct?
Yeah.
So they are members of the SA, who basically are you know, his thugs from the first thing, from the Munich beer putsch. So he's got former members of the Nazi party basically coming to see him in his house in Chartwell, or not?
Sorry, I've perhaps misrepresented that. No, it was someone who was fleeing
right.
from the
attack. Right, I was going to say, my mind was just completely blown from it then. Yeah.
No, so a gentleman who was transport secretary in one of the last cabinets of the Weimar government
right.
was a target on the Night of the Long Knives. And he is then brought by Germany's former chancellor to Winston Churchill's house. And this man, his recollections of that day are astonishing. He's actually in his tennis kit playing tennis at home when German troops, you know, Nazi troops turn up at his door to assassinate him. And he manages to evade capture, flee, come to Britain and meet Winston Churchill. So these are the astonishing meetings that, in my opinion, are I can't understand why they're not more well known. So I'm really excited to be able to share them in this book.
This is the thing, because we, you know, I mean, and I don't mean to drag him into the 21st century, because Winston is Churchill is Churchill, you know, a magnificent leader. But people get him wrong on the level that they think he was, as I said before, sprung fully formed this opinion and basically was saying, you know, came up with fighting on the beaches and all that sort of stuff. He was an incredibly complex figure and he listens to people. So rather than people go, oh, well, the reason we should have our borders shut is because that's what Churchill had done. Well, perhaps he wouldn't have, because he had the political nous to speak to a whole section of world society without having a prejudice, and from that information he was able to form what would come to be sort of his policies, his and the way that he looked in the world, which when the rest of the world was saying, you know, we must appease Hitler, it's not so bad, we can do a deal with them, the testimonies and the evidence that he had gathered from these years, and that allowed him to, if you like, to see the truth in Bonswick, he had done his research.
He was someone who would have gut instincts, but wouldn't rely solely on that for something as important as this, because he really was having to fight against such an overwhelming sense of the desire to avoid war. So in order to have clout in terms of the speeches and the articles he was writing, he had to back it up essentially with data, with first-hand accounts of what was going on. If he was just saying, I've got a bad feeling, people aren't going to listen to that, you know. So he is methodical in his approach to gleaning as much information as he can to support his arguments. And then as the 30s wear on, and unfortunately you see the Nazi Party's horrible process of kind of foreign policy aggression playing out, from the remilitarization of the Rhineland to Austria to Sudetenland, you see this sort of ripple effect. But he sees this much earlier. He says the Nazis are planning this, and you know what? You're all falling for it. They are doing it step by step. They've got this all planned out, and we're giving them everything they want. And it is quite astonishing that even in 1939, there's a considerable constituency in Westminster who still don't want to give him a seat at the table, even then.
Yeah, because he's kind of seen, you know, he's been a former first lord of the Admiral Tree. He's put down also that during the general strike, he's not exactly endeared himself to certain parts of the country. Presumably, this time it's also a family home, and he's got family there. He's got daughters. I mean, they are presumably young adults rather than sort of being ankle biters. But so what's it like as a house? Because we can say Chartwell and Citadel and the whole thing, but it's a family house at the same time. I'm not saying it's a two up, two down, but what's the actual house like itself?
Well, what I've done in Churchill's Citadel is try and balance that high politics and diplomacy with everyday life, family life, domesticity. So at the same time, example, you've got these incredible meetings happening. You've got one of his daughters eloping, running away with someone that, you know, she knows that mummy and daddy don't approve of. You've got things like the chauffeur quitting because he's doing too many late nights. There's so many lovely little angles of everyday life balanced alongside.
Can I just ask, imagine eloping with Winston Churchill's daughter and then coming back and having to face Winston.
Well, do you know what, actually, so Winston had met this gentleman before. Sarah Churchill, who's the Churchill's third child, she is a dancer, and in one of her earliest productions she meets a man called Vic Oliver, who is much older and divorced. Sarah brings him home to meet Papa at Chartwell. Doesn't go well. But she plays it very coolly. She says, do you know what? I can see that he's probably not right for me. And she puts on a brilliant act and then waits until her little sister's birthday and runs off to New York to marry this man. So you've got, and that's just one sort of strand of family drama that's happening at the same time. So yeah, it was definitely not a quiet house at Chartwell.
So how did you, what gave you the spark to put this particular book together? And where do you get the information from? Because again, I know of Chartwell, but I certainly didn't know everybody from Einstein to Lawrence, for example, Lawrence of Arabia.
Well, in my day job, I am the curator of Chartwell. Although this book has been written in my spare time, so evenings, weekends and holidays for 4 years has gone into creating Churchill Citadel. And so there is a visitor's book at Chartwell, which is a really good starting point, but that tended to only list the overnight guests. So it gives some of the people there, but not all. So my research involved archives all over the world, correspondences to and from Winston Churchill, his engagement cards, you know, Clementine's diaries, their daughter's diary, and sort of creating this wealth of information from which I could then draw out these meetings. And there are some absolutely brilliant ones in there. You know, you've got JFK's dad coming in 1935.
He was an interesting character, wasn't he? Yes.
Yeah, so Joseph P. Kennedy, he went on to become the American ambassador in London. Yeah, so he visits in 1935, and it's a really interesting time because it's not long after the Anglo-German naval agreement has been signed, which seems astonishing now, but we made a naval agreement with Germany at that point. Mm. And Churchill is looking, as you say, having been First Lord of the Admiralty in the past, at creating some sort of Anglo-American share. Naval police force is his sort of idea, and that's what he's pitching to Joe Kennedy. Unfortunately, that meeting doesn't go well. Kennedy doesn't take to Churchill at all, says, you know, I don't trust him. And so that's actually an example of a meeting that doesn't go Churchill's way, because if every one of these meetings went Churchill's way, then he would have come to power or influence much earlier.
I mean, Kennedy's got a backstory anyway. Kennedy has, you know, his view of the world is opposed to Churchill. So he's very much, you know, he's very much on, if you like, on the other camp, which makes him a very sort of, which shows where America is, where their, this was used, their America first policy, don't get involved with stuff over there. It doesn't affect on a nation coming out of a Great Depression, for example, and I know just getting the FDR's New Deal up and running. They don't want to be involved in European things and stuff happening over there. It's seen as the old empire. You know, we're America. We've got to deal with our problems first.
You're absolutely right that the isolationist policies of the United States do make it an uphill struggle to try and engage the United States in the likelihood of conflict playing out in Europe. And one of the moments in my book that is not very well known at all is a speech that Churchill broadcasts to NBC in the summer of 1939. So within weeks of war breaking out, and still a backbench MP at that point, but doing his bit even then, weeks away from war being declared, to desperately try and persuade the American people to ready themselves to support Britain and her allies.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you see what happens, the relationship that he has with America, he loves America. I mean, I've read books about his meals at the White House, and the dinner menus are outstanding. But it's really funny to think of them not being sort of not having that special relationship at the time. What's your favorite? Because I mean, you're walking around there, and you must. You must feel sort of the walls must sort of now and again spook you in a good way, you know, the echo. Because when you write about these situations, and you know, James Holland calls it walking the ground, you know, when you're actually saying, because it's living history. And I do that over here in Spain because I'm surrounded by history here as well. It must bring what you're writing so much to life, because you must look out over the lawn and think that's where Einstein did a Ford roll or something like that, you know?
I think the fact that I have been inadvertently walking the ground for 10 years definitely has helped the book. And I think that there's something I can bring to it in the sense that because I'm so imbibed with the place, I can even, you know how the light falls on a late summer afternoon in the garden, you know, and how the building creaks and, you know, all those sorts of things, just to make you have a real sense of what life is like there. But as well, I mean, some of my favourite stories are things like the secretaries and their recollections of life there. So I've tried to balance the staff perspective as well, because their worlds orbited around Chartwell almost as much as the Churchill. So it's a really rich variety of different stories and anecdotes.
And who, you know, somebody who's going to prepare his mouthwash, as he used to call it, you know, because people think he drank neat whiskey all day and that's why he always fell over or something. But he drank, didn't they? They called it mouthwash because it was literally sort of 15 parts water to a tiny bit of whiskey so he could have it through the day.
That's it. If you imagine you've got a glass and you are putting just enough whiskey that there is a thin film at the very bottom of the glass, and then it's water on top. So it's definitely not the case he was having neat whiskey all day, I can confirm.
Marvellous. What are you hoping that people will take from Churchill Citadel?
For me, I think that there is a prevailing belief that Chartwell was this sort of quiet, idyllic retreat with beautiful views. And it was a beautiful place, but to imagine that it was just where he would go to relax is completely missing the international significance of Chartwell. The fact that it was his factory of words, you know, in terms of his writing, he wrote more than William Shakespeare and Charles Dickens combined. And most of that in the study at Chartwell until 2 a.m, 3 a.m. And then, of course, these meetings happening to arm him with information around Germany preparing for war. So I want to counter that belief that Chartwell was just a scenic backdrop to Winston Churchill. For me, it is centre stage.
Presumably, he would have been quite sort of put out to have to go to Chequers then in that case, because it's, you know, it's, he got a yump the other side of the country. Or was he, because people say, oh, well, Chequers he's always been the Prime Minister's stronghold. But he must have been acquired, because you don't kind of know Chequers. It's like booking into a travel lodge, isn't it, basically? You kind of know where it is, but, you know, it's not exactly homely.
Well, so Chequers and Ditchley were both places he went when he was Prime Minister, and Chequers as his official residence. But in the 1930s, Chequers was not somewhere he had access to. But I'm sure he would have loved to have been back at Chartwell more during the war. But unfortunately, it was well known that Chartwell was going to be a target for the German Air Force. Yeah. They had this document called the Black Book, which listed essentially the places upon the successful invasion of Britain where they were going to make a beeline to. And Chartwell was pretty much top of the list. So they knew that it would be incredibly risky for Churchill to be there. But brilliantly, he had a plan to make it so that they could never find his house, and they never did.
What, do you put it on rollers or something and move it around a lot?
No, Chartwell has two very big lakes. And if you are flying over at night, bodies of water are what you're looking out for. So he had the lakes covered in leaves. And so they knew that they were looking for a house with a T-shaped house with two lakes. But alas, they found a T-shaped house, no lakes, can't be Churchill's house.
Brilliant. If people want to find out more about you or about the book, where's the best place to find you?
So I am on X, formerly known as Twitter, and my handle is at Katie Culture, so K-A-T-I-E Culture. Otherwise, to buy a copy of Churchill Citadel would be my recommendation, which is out later this month.
And you'll be able to order it via our own virtual bookstore. And just quickly, because you are at Chartwell, so people can visit, can't they? It's open to the public, etc.
Chartwell is indeed open to public. It's open year-round. The house itself is open from February to November, but then does Christmas opening as well. But the gardens are spectacular, and those views that Churchill fell in love with are worth it for a visit on their own. So, yes, you can come anytime and see Churchill's home.
And final question, what does the light look like falling on a summer evening across the, and looking out the same thing as Churchill did?
Well, what's brilliant is that view is unchanged. There's been no development within that view that he fell in love with. And my gosh, on a sunny summer's evening, you've got these glorious long shadows reaching down towards the lake as the light starts to turn warm. And it's just the most beautiful sight.
The book is called Churchill's Citadel. It's Chartwell and the Gatherings Before the Storm. It is by Catherine Carter, who is speaking to you today. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Catherine, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Giles.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Lowe's knows tough jobs call for tougher tools. The new DeWalt Elite Series Power Tool Accessories are built to last for the pro who doesn't stop. With precision fitment, durability, and impact resistance, finishing jobs faster has never been easier. Shop the new DeWalt Elite Series at an everyday low price, exclusively at Lowe's. We help, you save.